afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of October 2nd, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. We've got a lot to talk about this week, first of those things being that this is the special hurricane edition. I am currently between bands of the hurricane that's working its way up the Florida Peninsula, but the show must go on, and we are slap dab in the middle of things and would not dream of letting something as trivial as a hurricane get in the way of Information Week Live. Fortunately, joining me here on Information Week Live, I have two great guests, people I love having here in the virtual studio with me. Neither one of them had to work their way into a hurricane to join me. First off, we have from our sister publication, Dark Reading, Senior Editor Sarah Peters. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you for having me, Kurt. It's always a pleasure.
And we also have Information Week's Senior Editor, Jessica Davis. Jess, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this special hurricane edition. I'm very excited.
Well, it is. It's been interesting because this is one of those things that in some ways echoes a lot of what goes on in the IT world, where the word went out that something super terrible, awful, evil, vile was going to happen, and everyone prepared on that basis. And as it has turned out, it's been at least, we'll call it 20% less evil than we thought it might be. For the folks that are over directly on the coast, I think it has been plenty bad enough. But the eye of the hurricane stayed just far enough offshore that basically what we've gotten inland has been some rain and a little bit of wind. But it does bring up this whole thing. And Sarah, I'm glad that you're here because you focus on security. And I'm curious, in your way of looking at what goes on around you in the security world, Do people warn of worse things than are likely going to happen, or is computer security one of those rare areas where what people are warned about isn't really nearly as bad as what actually will happen?
That is a fascinating question, and I really don't know. I don't know how to answer it because it sort of depends on where you are and what you're dealing with. We have this problem of security fatigue right now, and that everybody's bombarded with we're all bombarded right now with things like, oh, there's another vulnerability, oh, there's another attack, blah, 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 blah. And to the point where people are so tired of hearing about breaches that we almost don't worry about them anymore. Because still, even though they happen all the time, it almost doesn't affect people when they hear about them anymore. And so to some degree, this fatigue syndrome, I would say, makes people think that, I would say that for some people, they underreact about things, and that to some degree it's worse than they think it is. But then to another degree, there is also, we have this issue in security media where we have these branded vulnerabilities, things like, you know, when the Heartbleed and these other attacks and vulnerabilities that come out, that sometimes it's like, this is the worst thing ever and everybody should be terrified. And it's actually not the worst thing ever. It might be really bad for some people, but it's really more of a threat, something that could happen under very, very distinct, discrete circumstances. And maybe it's just a threat of something that could happen if you have the right staff. It's not actually an attack yet. It's just a proof of concept. It's not in the wild. And you add on all of these caveats. And once you add on all the caveats, it's not really that bad. And we have to be responsible when we report on it to make sure that we don't all overblow everything. So I think it really depends on the circumstance. When you get down into the stuff when it comes to like who the bad guys are, I do think that oftentimes in general, there's still those people who think nobody wants what we've got. Why would anybody want to attack me? Why would anybody want my data? I do still think that's the general attitude of a lot of people. And that is the wrong attitude. I think for the most part, everybody's got something that somebody wants. And so in that regard, I would say we underreact.
Well, underreacting seems to be the rare sort of thing. Jessica, I've got to ask you, now you spend much of your time looking at enterprise software. And by that, we mean the back-end software that companies use to run their biggest, most critical systems. There are often stories that go out about critical vulnerabilities, about weaknesses, about problems. What is your take? I mean, is this a case where you hear people in the industry being warned of things that where the warning is much worse than anything that's really going to happen? Or is this another case where the warnings tend to be fairly mild and the companies that you see are risking horrible things by not taking them sufficiently seriously?
Well, you know how it is really in that nobody really wants to tell a reporter about all their vulnerabilities and how they didn't pay attention to them. So I haven't been in the seat of getting a really interesting scoop where somebody just spills their guts about how they left vulnerabilities unpatched, if that's the right word. But it makes me think back to, I can remember speaking of the hurricanes and over-preparing versus under-preparing, the case of disaster recovery efforts. And I remember with Hurricane Sandy, there were so many smaller IT organizations that I was covering at the time that lost on-premises servers and a lot of their equipment and were unable to operate for days. And it makes me wonder, and I wish I'd looked into this before today's show, but it makes me wonder if that spurred any movement to the cloud following that kind of a disaster and whether it's has less of an impact today if companies are operating in data centers versus on-premises. I don't know. But maybe they don't have to prepare as much as they did in disaster recovery scenarios as they did back then.
Well, I think one thing that's certainly true is that the cloud has made disaster recovery a different kind of animal than it once was, because I know that back around the Y2K issue, I went and saw a couple of very large disaster recovery facilities, and we're talking about things like what was at that time the third largest bank in the nation, having a full mirror site at this facility with multiple OC-192 lines pulled between their main data center and this hot backup system. I mean, this was one where they were saying that they would lose no more than about 1.2 seconds worth of transactions if the worst happened and their major data center went completely offline. Well, in the cloud, That kind of resilience is one of the things that's supposed to be baked in. But a lot of companies don't really trust the cloud to handle that sort of thing. It was really interesting. I was at Splunks.conf a few days ago. There was a great deal of talking about how they were using those tools to monitor what was going on in the cloud and provide security monitoring for what was going on in the cloud. Sarah, do you find that the cloud is actually having an impact on the way companies deal with their security, or have they pretty much just taken their on-premises security posture and moved it to the cloud?
It's made a huge impact on how people do their security, and it's not the kind of thing that they can just you can't just do security in the cloud exactly the same way that you did it on-prem. And a lot of people, I think, one of the reasons that hybrid cloud environments are so popular and so attractive is because of security, because there are some things that that organizations still want to keep on-prem, although cloud services now have, out of necessity, become a lot more have provided a lot more security services for their cloud offerings. There's still some in some instances, and I think that this still makes sense to just keep stuff at home. But the interesting, the kind of the places that that security gets really weird in the cloud, the positive side of it is like what you guys were saying with disaster recovery. It gives you that redundancy, which is excellent. It gives you a place to put all of your backups. So from that availability standpoint, cloud services are obviously excellent for security. But from a compliance standpoint, all of that data sovereignty stuff gets a little kludgy. So, for example, with if you got users in Europe, privacy law that applies to European citizens, and it does not apply to American citizens, and a lot of companies are trying to struggle with that question of, well, should I just have servers in Europe just to deal with European data? Because as soon as I move their data across borders, everything gets really confusing, and that data needs to be handled differently. That data needs to be secured differently. That data needs to be verified differently. I mean, it's just that the compliance stuff gets very, very confusing. And then there's also just the question of if you need to collect logs on that data, if you need to have access to that data, if you need to if you need to find that data at all, you've got now this third party involved that you cannot just show up at the data center and take a look at how everything is secured, because you don't have that direct access to it. You can't prove compliance in the same way that you did before. And so it does change the way that people did things even just 5 years ago. The good thing is that there are now there's this whole realm of security as a service as well now. So now you can get a lot of security products that come to you through the cloud. And encryption is kind of end-to-end encryption services that we're seeing now are really fascinating. So it's evolving rapidly, and it's exciting stuff. I think it's pretty exciting, but absolutely it changes the way everybody does everything.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned security as a service. While I was at the Splunk conference, I sat down with a gentleman named Atif Ghari, who is the chief technology officer of the Herjavec Group. Herjavec Group is a very large security as a service service provider. And it was interesting talking with him about exactly what they do and how they do it. It is most fascinating to hear security described as a service. Of course, we're used to physical security being provided as a service. I think all of us are accustomed to seeing things like armored trucks roll up and down the streets carrying bank deposits and things like that. And private security is all over every shopping mall in the nation. But when we apply it to the computer realm, suddenly it becomes a very different kind of feeling thing. Jess, I wanted to pivot to you and talk about services, because this last week there were a couple of big conferences out in the world of software as a service, and I know you went to one. The one that I don't believe you got the chance to go to was Dreamforce, which is the annual conference of people who use the Salesforce platform. And the biggest news that I think came out of Dreamforce is that they managed to score U2 as the evening's entertainment for their attendees. And a former colleague of ours was in about row six, making everyone jealous with his Facebook photos coming from the field there.
His commentary was fantastic, too.
I missed that.
For those of you who are longtime listeners, you'll recall our colleague Dave Wagner, who is now off doing analyst things. Well, he was at Dreamforce and in the business of making us all very jealous from being at Dreamforce. Now, Jess, you went to a conference for Hadoop, which isn't by itself a software as a service platform, but it certainly sits beneath a lot of services out there. So what was going on in the world of Strata and Hadoop this week?
Yeah, so I went to the Strata Hadoop New York event recently, and it's really become a big data event, not just about Hadoop, but was lucky enough to sit in on several different sessions, including one that I wrote about this week, which was about LinkedIn, which most people know as the careers networking site. LinkedIn also has a very big play in big data and in creating some of the technologies that are used in big data, including, I think they spun off, they contributed to the Apache Software Foundation technology, such as Kafka, which is very hot right now for real-time big data. But anyway, the LinkedIn session at Strata Hadoop was really about how they redid their mobile app and how they used retooling of the mobile app, that complete redesign of the mobile app, to go back and look at their data code base and go back and look at were all the different application teams within the company using the same terms when they were talking about profile views. Well, they weren't doing it all the time, and that made things complicated. So LinkedIn made the choice to go back and redo it all and create really a governance strategy for the entire company and their back-end software to serve the mobile app, and ultimately this will also serve the desktop app too when they get to that redesign as well. And it was a tough choice to make because it seems like a big job, right, to go back and fix everything and make everything consistent and get buy-in from all different organizations within the company. And it really becomes a cultural issue, too. And when you have a company with 10,000 employees, as LinkedIn does now, now they're part of Microsoft, but as LinkedIn itself has 10,000 employees, it's not a small task to keep the communication going among all the team members who need to be involved and get them to standardize on a set of terms, a set of processes to continue that process. But because they took the time to do this remodeling of the code, it's going to save them time in the future, and they're going to be able to scale their applications and the work they're doing in the data more easily than they've been able to do in the past because things are consistent now. And so that was a really fascinating story about a company that a lot of people think of as a digital native company, but that still has had to go back and sort of redo a lot of the foundation of their code in order to make it possible to go forward and continue to grow fast.
You know, that's an interesting point because I think for a lot of companies, the idea of going through and scrapping code of any sort is a really painful decision. I mean, code now is considered one of the big assets that a company is going to have, and they see scrapping code as taking, something like their corporate name and heaving it overboard. But sometimes it's absolutely the right thing to do. And Sarah, I want to turn to you and ask you that question based on security. You know, we tend to think that security is one of these things where we always are building on top of what we did before, but are there times when companies or the entire industry, for that matter, needs to take what they have in place in one area or another, throw it out, and just start over? I'm thinking of things like the difference between signature-based malware prevention and heuristics. Once you go to heuristics, you really are throwing out that old code base that you were comparing against. Is that the kind of thing that goes on often, or in your opinion, should it go on more often than it does?
Well, I mean, so you're talking about two different kinds of things right there. When it comes to code, I would think that a lot of security people would love the idea of having applications with fewer lines of code. I mean, those of us here are editors, right? We like shorter stories because you know that the more words there are, the more opportunities there are for error, right? Like the same rule applies to the more lines of code there are in an application, the more opportunities there are to introduce a vulnerability. So things like just being kind of good hygiene and being more, I guess just being a little more, writing tighter code is something that is part of writing secure code. And in that respect, just tossing the whole thing out, I think most security people recognize is not always realistic. Starting from scratch is not necessarily realistic, but I think that from an idealistic point of view, I think a lot of them would love to be able to do that. When it comes to things like your example of detecting of malware detection, at this point, I don't hear anybody suggesting toss out your signature-based malware detection altogether and put in this new thing. not even really the forward thinking companies selling the software that does not use signature based stuff. Not so much. If you're in that behavioral based anti malware space, the pitch mostly is CISO, you know your signature based malware detection really isn't catching everything, right? You know it's way behind schedule, right? You know it's not really doing everything. You kind of need our product to get all that other stuff and do the job a lot faster, but don't necessarily chuck out all that other stuff you've got just yet. I don't think most security companies, honestly, don't want to be held accountable for weakening your security. So most of them are very shy about suggesting that you should axe some other part of your system and replace it with theirs, because most people don't want to say, I can guarantee to keep you more secure. There is a very, very shy and burgeoning movement now to start guaranteeing products, but the people who are starting that movement do get a lot of pushback, because they're like, we don't want to guarantee our products. You know, nobody can guarantee security. So for the most part, they're not suggesting rip and replace. It's mostly this layered approach. Instead of rip and replace, it's more have more tools that collectively should do the job.
I don't know about... I don't know, a little more than half a decade ago, a little before you and I started working together, I was doing some work with a security company, one that specialized in advanced persistent threats. Mm-hmm. And one of the arguments they made was, you know what, your perimeter is leaky like a sieve anyway, so all of that perimeter stuff you're doing is just a distraction. Go ahead, get rid of it. We're fast enough. We will recognize an intrusion when it happens and let you SWAT it immediately. And it was interesting because the bulk of their customers were either nation states or agencies around the world, most closely identified by three or four letters. And it was an interesting group to work with and an interesting argument to make. But I think even most of their customers, they said, yes, we love your stuff, and no, we're not getting rid of our firewall.
Yeah, I mean, it's very few. It's very few that will make that argument confidently. And those that make that argument still don't convince many of their customers to toss out the perimeter controls. Not yet. It's happening, but on a very slow, slow pace. 97% of companies will still have a firewall, if not more.
Well, it is fascinating. This has been a great conversation, and it disturbs me that we have run through half an hour of time. It seems like we have just barely scratched the surface on all kinds of things, and our audience, we normally wouldn't tell them this, but coming into the show, I think all of us were going, what on earth are we going to talk about today? There hasn't been a really big news thing, so we were all kind of grasping at straws on what we were going to talk about, and as is common in our industry, there was a lot to talk about. And it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot less to talk about. One of the things that we didn't get to that I want to at some point in the future, and I'm going to make sure that both of you are here when we do it, the whole question of esports, the idea that you want to watch someone else play video games. I consider the fact that I don't get this to be one of many indications that I am, in fact, an old fart, and that's fine. I can own that designation. But I would love to talk some about esports and specifically what it means for our industry. because I think there are probably some implications there that I would love to get into. So I will look forward to having you both back on to talk about that. And in the meantime, Jessica, let's go with you first. I know that you have tons that you're working on. What should our listeners be looking for from you at informationweek.com?
Yeah, so next week I will be working on putting together a few more stories from the sessions at Strata Hadoop. I know Netflix is another greatly admired company, and they were there talking about their stack of data technology. So that's one of the things I'll be writing about next week.
Outstanding. And how should people keep up with you on social media?
Best place is on Twitter, and I am at Jessica Davis, no space.
Well, Jessica, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Sarah, how about you? I know that the pages of darkreading.com would not be the same without you. What are you keeping your eye on, and what should people be looking for from you over at Dark Reading?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned gaming, because I am working on a story that will be about a report forthcoming on the cyber criminal roots of selling online gaming currency. So that should be interesting. And then I'm also working on a thing about the 30th birthday of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which the anniversary of the CFAA is on October 16th, so I'm going to take a look back in time at that.
Very good. And how can people keep up with you over on the Tweety Pipes?
I'm at Sarah Peters, no H in Sarah.
And you didn't say it, but I will. Our listeners should absolutely keep up with Sarah on matters of computer security. But if you're one of those poor, deluded folks who is a New York Knicks fan, you really ought to follow her. She doesn't write about the Knicks that often for Dark Reading, but she does follow the Knicks for Bleacher Report, and her reading or her writing on the Knicks is absolutely stellar. So be sure to follow her for all the stuff that's worth reading about the New York Knicks. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us today.
I have another Twitter account that I mostly do that on, but you can find account by going through my Sarah Peters account. So you can find them by going there.
You have permission. I'm the host. What is your Knicks account?
it's a little hard to figure out, but it's at 3 from the 7, because I'm off the 7 train in Queens. So, that's why I say it's a little hard to keep track. It's a little hard to understand, but if you were in New York, it would make more sense.
Okay, so follow both of those. You'll be glad you did. As for me, I'm continuing to look at DevOps. I've got a piece coming up. I'm going to be looking at a bunch of open source DevOps tools. I've also got a new podcast coming out over in the Information Week's Expert Voice series. A couple of folks that I interviewed at Splunks.conf, one who is big into the world of security, the other who, integration of lots of different companies and their IT teams, talking a little bit about the kind of tools he's using to try and collapse 40 data centers down to 4. So be on the lookout for that. You can find me on social media at KG4GWA, and I hope you will. Well, that's it for another episode of Information Week Live, this one for the week of October 2nd, 2016. We will be back once again next week to see what has happened then, and with any luck at all, I won't be coming to you from the outer wall of a hurricane. So for Jessica Davis, Sarah Peters, and everyone here at Information Week Live. I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. See you next week.